Do you know which natural area is the size of 5 national parks out west, including the Grand Canyon, but is located in the northeast part of the United States? Would you like to know how to put together a remote trip in the Northeast and some of the newest gear that's going to keep you safe and allow you to have a much more enjoyable trip? And have you ever wondered what it's like to live in a van down by the river while running your business and having a normal life? Today, we have David Brotson on the podcast to share his story and how he put it all together. This is the Wet Fly Swing Podcast, where we show you the best places to travel to for fly fishing, how to find the best resources and tools to prepare for that trip, and what you can do to give back to the fish species we love. Hey, I'm Dave, host of the Wet Fly Swing Podcast. I've been fly fishing since I was a kid. I grew up around a fly shop and have created one of the largest fly fishing podcasts in this country. I've also interviewed more of the greatest fly anglers and told some of the greatest stories than anyone in the world. Today, David Brotson is going to share his story of how he put together this remote trip into the Au Sable River Canyon and the 3 biggest takeaways he has to help you to create your own successful trip. You're going to learn which boat is by far the best to use if you're going to be trying to stay light and nimble and save a bunch of weight. We find out which satellite service is best for safety and what you can do if you're living in a van as well. And some of the big trout routes features that helped him to plan this trip and execute it perfectly. We dig into that today, why you should have a mapping software and an app. Plus, we find out again how David did it all while transferring his life into a Ford Transit and literally built this thing out by his hands, step by step. We've got some inspiration for you today. David Brotson from @verygoodflyfishing on Instagram. How you doing, David?
Good. Good to be here. I'm super stoked.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. This is going to be a fun one. I think that you have some stuff going on that's pretty exciting to talk about because you have the van life, which we're going to talk about a little bit, but you also did a trip out to the kind of Adirondacks, that area, and you have this video which is playing right now. We're going to talk about that as well. And I think your experience of getting into fly fishing maybe a little bit later might be part of this story too. So today we're going to dig into that and maybe some tips on planning, a Eastern trip, maybe like a remote trip out east. So we're going to get into all that today. Before we start there, let's bring us back to fly fishing. How'd you get into it and kind of what's your first memory of it?
So I'm pretty new to fly fishing and I'm pretty openly new about fly fishing. And I got started kind of amongst where a lot of people started to pick up some more outdoor stuff, which is like right around the COVID area where we all kind of locked down and getting antsy to get outside. I've had a background in outdoor stuff since I was super young. I basically lived in the Adirondacks all summer when I was growing up in my teen years. And I've always like had this like small little passion for fishing where it's like I didn't do it too much when I was a kid, but every time that I would start fishing it'd take hours to pull me away from it type of thing. But yeah, it kind of rose through antsiness and kind of being locked in my house for a little while. And it actually started a little bit more on like the gear fishing side of fishing, where I had no idea what I was doing. It's kind of like a rekindled flame that I had for fishing. And so I was like, I got my dad, I was like, we should go fishing. And he was like, okay. He's like, well, he doesn't fish that much. I hadn't fished that much. I lived in the city. And so during COVID, I was like, all right, well, I'm going to get on Facebook Marketplace. I'm going to find a boat because I was like, that's the first thing you need to do to fish. And so I bought this boat. We restored it. And then me and my dad went and got some like spin gear and we went out to a lake and we caught nothing like for weeks. Like we kept like trying to revisit this one lake and stuff. It's beautiful. There's humongous bass in it. There's lake trout, there's salmon in this one portion of the Adirondacks. And we were trying and trying and trying. And actually my wife who had come up with us, she was the only one catching. She caught like 100 bluegill in one day on like an ice fishing rod. And so I was like, okay, well, this makes me only want to fish more because I can't catch anything. And so I had actually went back home and one of my buddies, Jake, was like, hey man, come fly fishing with me. And I was like, okay. I was like, how how do I do that? And so he was like, well, you're going to need a rod. He's like, just go pick something up. So I think I got like a Reddington 8-weight or something like that. I just kind of picked up a kit rod and I still actually have that thing with me, which is awesome. But he brought me to one of the salmon runs in Western New York. We've got the Chinook, we got the Atlantic, we have Steelhead and Browns and all that sort of stuff coming through the system. I'd never heard of it. I had no idea that like 10 minutes down the road from my house, we have fish the size of me going up the river. And for context, I'm not the tallest guy in the world. I'm about 5'5", 5'6" on a good day. And I pulled probably the biggest fish I've ever seen in my life out of the water. And I was literally, and pun fully intended, I was hooked. Like it was one of the craziest experiences for me.
Wow. So you pulled out a Chinook on like one of your first trips?
One of my first trips. We had like an egg sucking leech on there. I was swinging a fly. I had no idea what I was doing. I barely knew how to cast. All I knew how to do was get the fly in front of myself. And he was like teaching me some rod stuff. I was like, all right, heck yeah. And all of a sudden I just feel this massive tug like this. I was like, I think I'm stuck on either a log or there's a whale on the other end of my line. And he's like, dude, that's a fish. And so I set the hook and that my reel was screaming for a little while. And finally we ended up pulling the thing in and I pulled it up out of the water. I was like, oh my gosh, this is insane.
This is great. Now this is cool because this is on the Reddington rod, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is class. I think I might've saw you guys maybe on your road trip. I think you might've been working with Reddington Rio maybe on some stuff, but so I think this is an amazing story because first of all, it just shows you that it doesn't really matter what rod you have for the most part. I mean, Reddington's a great company, obviously.
Sure.
But you pick up this Reddington rod, you have no idea, and you go out there and hook a giant Chinook salmon on your first trip. Like that for sure doesn't, amazing.
Yeah, like literally zero experience whatsoever. And it's kind of, I don't know, I think that was, that being my intro to fly fishing was kind of like the best part because it is truly like anyone can start fly fishing if you have the patience for one. It definitely wasn't first cast. It was one of those things where I get locked in to something and I'm sitting on the river and I can stand there for 3 hours. I'm happy to do it. If I kind of know that there's a chance, there's a 1% chance that I might hook up on a fish. But other than that, like it was an amazing intro to the sport. It's kind of just like, oh my gosh, like this is done and it can happen. That's the other thing too, is you have someone experienced like my buddy, and then you've got guides in the industry and all that other stuff. And those guys will put you on fish and it's totally possible to be kind of a novice and figure it out and connect to the fish, which is, I think, the best part.
That's really cool. Yeah, that's a great story starting off. What is your, we're going to talk about more on kind of maybe some remote trip stuff, but what would be a couple of tips you would give somebody that's kind of new or telling somebody how to help them get into fly fishing? What helped you to really, was it just that? Did you hook that fish and you're like, okay, I'm good to go, or any other tips you throw out there?
No, I think that was kind of the start of it. Like you get the feeling of hooking into a Chinook salmon and it's early in the season, so that thing fights hard. And so that's like the initial moment that like you're stoked and you're on the river, and that's the feeling that you kind of strive for every time you hit the river. But I mean, the other thing too is like kind of exactly what you said, which is like not to get too obsessed about the gear. And like that'd be kind of one of the bigger things. It's like just get started, go grab a rod and kind of get out there.
And what you said, I think this is another big part of it. The gear, I think, is a great one because many people have said you can't buy a bad rod these days. You know, everything's pretty great. But also you hooked a fish on your first time. And I've heard that before from guides talking about and teachers like, hey, we need to get this person into fish as soon as possible.
Yeah.
That's the key, you know, and I think that you did exactly that because, you know, you could see it if you went for a year without touching the fish, you might be like, you know, is this thing for me? But you got into it right away, right?
Yeah. And I think that was the other thing too, that kind of hooked me to fly fishing, because with gear fishing and whatnot, and there's a lot of guys where it's like, yeah, like throw a worm on a bobber and you'll catch something, like something will come up. And I think diving into fly fishing kind of opened this massive door to learning what like a river ecosystem looks like and where to find fish. And I think diving into all those things was one of like the most fascinating things for me, is how trout behave, how rivers behave, and how differently you fish them from like a still water pond or a lake or anything like that. And so I think that was the other thing too, is it's like, it's so interesting to kind of learn that stuff for myself personally. And I know a lot of dudes get nitty gritty with it too. And so it is kind of like a cool thing to be able to break down and almost find a science behind something that there is no science to, like actually getting a fish on your hook. Like you got the best guides in the world and some days they'll still get skunked. And that's like that's the fun and that's the pull of it. is getting out there and the mystery. And I mean, the other thing too is, like, for myself, I am growing up and I've got this job in filmmaking and I'm in the city, and I kind of don't get a ton of chances to go outside and get far outside of like downtown Rochester. And this was a huge thing that just, like, it was such a peaceful and mind calming experience that I was like, wow, like, this is really, really cool to be able to have something that is beneficial to, like, that quick, fleeting feeling of catching a fish, where it's like, oh, wow, like, that was a huge burst of, like, I'm so stoked, to, like, just even being out there and not even catching a fish. You're like, wow, like, this is so calming. And there's two, like, it's like a double-sided benefit type of situation, which I find is amazing. And one of the best things about fly fishing.
That is good. Nice. So, and we're just looking. Yeah. So you're in New York. We were down in December. We were fishing, like, kind of more around Buffalo, fishing kind of the south shore of Lake Erie, fishing for steelhead.
Oh, heck yeah.
So yeah, New York, the cool thing about New York is how diverse it is. I think a lot of people don't always realize, you know, like, the diversity, right? You got that. And then the Adirondacks, where you guys were going to talk about today. But I want to go back quickly on that boat. I love the boat talk. So describe that boat you guys, like, refinished. What type of boat was that?
Yeah, well, so we ended up getting a vintage Miracraft. It's like this baby blue. It's right out of the catalog. I think, honestly, I'm not even joking, I think we found it at some point. There's a Sears catalog excerpt.
Okay, what year is it? What year is the boat? Do you have any idea?
It's a 65, I believe.
Oh, amazing.
Pretty sure it's super old. And when we got it, it, like, these boys out in the country, they've been like, put turf in it. They were like, yeah, the metal hurts our feet type of thing. And so me and my dad, like, first thing we did is we restored it. We put, like, a full teak flooring in and treated everything and made it super, super nice. Restored the leather on the seats, repainted the entire boat.
Oh, wow. There's actually leather on the seats.
Yeah, like, it's blue teal leather, which is, like, super sick.
And is the front of the boat, is it kind of a, I mean, that, I think that's a cool thing. Like, you don't see boats like this anymore, but it's got kind of a nice, smooth, rounded, polished point front. And, like, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm looking at it now. And it's almost like, this almost is the boat, like, you'd see, I think, what they copied, like, in Star Wars, the movie, those little, you'd have to look at it. We'll put a link in the show notes to this thing. But essentially, I mean, it's old school, and you guys refinished this thing and, like, put what, like, a 30 horsepower motor or something like that on it?
Yeah, I think we've got a 40 horsepower on it. And we kind of tried to stay as original as we could to it. It's like one of those, like, JFK cruisers type of thing. It's like a beautiful boat, but, like, it's also fun to throw a few rods under the seat and drop in the middle of the lake and start fishing,
so cool.
Type of thing. Yeah, it's really, and we have the Erie Canal right up near us in through Rochester. So, like, we'll take it all the time. And obviously you can only go 5 miles an hour on the canal or whatever, but it's such a fun, like, hit the river type of thing and just cruise in, get ice cream or something like that in town or whatever. Yeah, it's a fun, like, multi-purpose boat. And I think it was the start of my fishing, like, mentality, but it was also, like, it's just one of those cool things to just always have around. It's a fun little project we did.
Perfect, perfect. Good. Well, let's jump into, I want to talk about this trip, because I think this is really kind of, sounds like a pretty memorable trip for you. Like,
yeah.
How did this, maybe describe, first of all, how this trip came to be, and then why, what that part where you traveled to is so, so unique.
Yeah, for sure. Now, so, obviously, my fishing experience kind of started only a couple of years ago in the East. Like, it's really specific to, like, my Rochester and my New York waters. And so I've started to learn more and more about the New York waters. I'm studying, like, just doing as much as I can when it comes to the fish, the species, the entomology, like, everything about the rivers that we have around us. And I got fascinated with the idea of going out west. I started this Instagram page, which means that all of my, like, suggested stuff gets, I'm getting hit with Fly Lord stuff. I'm getting Fly Life Media, like the dudes down in Brazil. Like, you're getting all these places around the world where these people are catching, like, the craziest fish you've ever seen. And I was like, dang, like, I would love to do that. And so that's kind of where the van build and all that whole idea kind of came about. And we shot out west this last summer. And got to experience it firsthand. So we get all of this fishing done in Colorado and Wyoming and Montana and South Dakota. And it's like fishing like I've never seen before. But to be honest, like I'm almost constantly comparing it back to the East where like my home waters are. And not as a comparison to be like, oh, well, this is so much better. This is so much better. It was kind of just like to see like do you have to do these crazy traveling moves in order to find fish and find a good fly fishing experience? And I think that was my idea going into this film, is I called my buddy on our way home. We were going to come back for the holidays, and we ended up coming back a little bit early because I had this idea for the film, where I was like, man, we should do what we did out west, which all the cool things about out west fly fishing, like obviously there's differences. The east is walk and wade a good majority of the time, and the west you're floating a ton. So those are all new experiences. I've never been on a float boat until this last summer with the Backcountry Skins guys in Alberta. Like one of the guys who's a buddy of theirs, Ty, took us out. And I was like, oh my gosh, like not only is this a job, like this is like, this is a lot of work to fish from a float boat. But it was just because I had never done it before, but with good guidance, like I had, we had an amazing guide.
And what was this now? Describe this a little bit, David. Sure. What was this boat, the float boat?
The float boat, I'm honest, I have no idea what the brand of the boat was.
Or, but what, talk about the experience. So this is, you're not talking about a float plane sort of thing.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, like just general, like floating the river type of situation.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. And that whole thing just kind of came out of like, we had gone up with these guys, the Backcountry Skins team, it's two brothers who had started this sweet neoprene company kind of for wet wading and whatnot. But yeah, we went up to them. We fished in the Rockies with those dudes. They brought us deep into the backcountry. Like their name stays true to what they kind of do it on a daily basis. These dudes are wild. But they brought us in the backcountry. We had fished for some bull trout, which is amazing. They brought us to some alpine lakes. And then like the last 2 days we were there, that he was like, let me set you up with my buddy Ty. Let's do a little float. And I was like, well, sick. I was like, that, yeah, that'd be amazing. I've never done that before. So this is a cool little thing. And I'd love to learn. Like that's kind of this whole experience. And that's why I started this page, is to just show growth and learning and figuring out the fly fishing space. And so he took us out, and I'm going to be honest, when it does compare to the east and west, like I haven't seen fish this big. I haven't seen bugs this big. Alberta was absolutely insane. I mean, your minimum fish is like 20 inches, maybe.
And these are bull trout, right?
Well, so yeah, that we targeted bull trout the first day. The day of the float, we had rainbow trout and brown trout and cutthroat. Just because that's like, in the water was freezing cold. It's the middle of July. It was wild because out east, the walk and wade streams get way too hot. You got to target something else.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he took us out and we were catching huge fish on huge flies. Like we had, I think it was a stonefly hatch. And these are 2-inch foam flies that we're throwing with a tiny little dropper, maybe some sort of midge or a nymph of some sort. And these fish are just, like, you'd think, from my experience, I'd think some of the fish out east, like, they're pretty eager. Big fish will jump pretty high. Out west, you get these tiny lips, or not tiny, but big lips that just come up and open their mouth, and the fly falls right in. And so I was like, I didn't even see that go down. I just watched my fly disappear. So I'm setting the hook on nothing, what seems to be like a ghost. And then all of a sudden we're on for like a 10-minute fight. And I'm like, oh man, this is insane. But yeah, it's aspects like that that I kind of wanted to apply to the east. And I've got my buddy Addison, who went on this fly fishing trip with me, the Adirondacks one. I was like, I just want to show him what like life in the west is compared. And I kind of want to combine them, because most of the time your mindset is like, oh, the east is this way and the west is this way, and it's separated, as opposed to like taking things that you learned kind of from all over and applying it to maybe home waters you're more comfortable with, or just kind of creating the space for there to be an amazing adventure. And I think that's kind of what we wanted to do. It was kind of open-ended, this plan, but all we knew we wanted to do is we wanted to float, we wanted to camp for multiple days, and we wanted to find a good river that had like a healthy fish population, a healthy group that was working on conservation and conserving the river. And that was kind of the whole idea, is we just wanted to have an adventure. But I think as we got deeper and deeper into the film, it just turned into so much more, which I think is kind of the best part about outdoor adventures.
This is great. And the video might not be out there. Maybe talk about, because this podcast will live out there for a while. Where, maybe in the future or right now, can say, what's the name of it? Where can they find this video?
Yeah, so we're still working on it. It's still kind of in the old chop shop, because I'm the only one editing it. And I'm sure you know from editing these podcasts and whatnot, it can get to be a lot when you've got so much. We brought cinema cameras. We had massive setups with us in our boats as we floated for 3 days. And we ended up working up, like, for the techie dudes out there, we got I think over 4 terabytes of footage for this film.
How many gigs are in a terabyte?
I think, what is it, 1,000?
1,000.
Yeah, it's 1,000.
I don't know.
I should know
I'm
that.
Guessing. Yeah, well, that will, yeah, that's good. Something like that. So yeah, 1,000 gigs. So a gigabyte is huge. Like this file that we're probably having here is going to be, you know, half a gig maybe.
Yeah.
And you're talking about like how many terabytes?
I think it was 4 terabytes. I got multiple drives that are just chocked full.
There you go. So, okay. So it's a ton of content. And why do the giant, the big cameras? Why not just do something, you know, whatever, all the smaller stuff that the tech and, or even say a phone sort of thing, right?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, I started this whole thing because I kind of wanted to, the page for context, I started the page because I kind of wanted to create things outside of just absolute perfection. And I think with my day job, which is as a DP, cinematographer, and filmmaker, I didn't really have that opportunity that often. Everything that I had to make had to be super polished, and it had to go through multiple rounds of revisions, and everything had to be clean when it's going to a client type of thing, as opposed to it just kind of being something that you create for creating. And that was the idea behind the page, which was like, I'd love to create all this stuff and do things that show my personality and fish and do things like run and gun and on the fly. And I do have a lot of gear that kind of pertains to that, which is my phone and GoPros and small Sony cameras and whatnot. But this film in particular, I wanted to tell the story the best way that I knew how. And that was to use the gear that I use on a daily basis and make it as polished and kind of the first intro into my abilities in fly fishing, but also like in parallel, my abilities in filmmaking and storytelling. So that was kind of the big pull for us, because there was a point where I was like, we're not bringing the cinema cameras. This is going to be insane.
Right.
And after we did, it was a grind. And I'm so glad we did it, because the footage that I'm seeing after we did all this stuff, I'm just so stoked. And I know the companies that we worked with too are super excited, like Eric from Trout Routes and all those guys, like showing them some clips and whatnot.
Yeah. So what is the difference on that? Just for those that don't know, I'm curious, because I don't have the background, but what are you seeing in that, the video of these larger high-tech cameras versus, say, the other stuff? Like, what is the difference? Is it just clear? Is that the biggest thing? Or what are you seeing?
I think it's characteristic of the footage. Like, you obviously know a video from someone's phone compared to a video for Fly Lords, right? Like, the footage is just absurd. And it's like you're watching a movie. And the characteristic of a bigger cinema camera, like, those are things that kind of expand a little bit of a palette when it comes to color, and it comes to how I can manipulate the footage as a storyteller. And when I say manipulate, I mean like adding color, because I'm a colorist. That's my specialty, is coloring. And so like taking that and making it something that is an extra set of, it's almost like the camera itself is that the canvas, not to get too artsy here, but you've got the canvas, and then once I get into my editing softwares and all the things that I use in the industry, that's when I can start to paint, and you can start to see my touch as a filmmaker and a creator on the footage. And it's kind of tough in this day and age to do that with an iPhone, because everybody's footage looks the exact same unless they do something extra to it. And so there's characteristics that people can tell through storytelling that you're like, oh, like this is somebody else, or I think I know who's doing this. Whereas with the other gear, it makes it a lot easier for me to kind of do that and almost put my mark on it as a person who's kind of creating the film from scratch.
This is awesome. This is awesome. And so is there a name yet for this, or is there some way to find it, say, in the future?
Yeah. And because of the comparisons between the two, the West and the East, I've combined it again with the general name is the Wild Wild East. And so it's just kind of, there's this Western theme to kind of the whole thing. And I think it's a fun like twist, because you can kind of tell the difference between when people are making something specifically for the East, where it's like these freezing cold steelhead videos. And then you've got the videos from Fly Lords out in West, and everybody's wearing cowboy hats, and it's a vibe on the float boats and all that sort of stuff. And I think kind of combining those two, where it's like, you've got all these aspects of floating what is normally a walk and wade river. And we obviously had to do a decent amount of walking, but yeah, I think that's the fun part of it. But the film itself, we're shooting to do early spring, and we've got a couple of releases. We're going to do some live showings across the country. I know there's a couple places in Colorado. There's a couple of we might be able to show it in Toronto and definitely in Rochester. We're going to head back up to New York and show it there, which Rochester is the home of Kodak.
And oh, nice.
So it's a pretty cool like little connection there that like to do my first film in fly fishing. Obviously I've had other ones beforehand or else I probably wouldn't still be working in this industry, but something that's specific to fly fishing, it's something that's fully made by myself. And yeah, to do it in the city of Kodak, I think is like it's a fun kickoff to the film. And then it'll be available on Vimeo and YouTube, as well as I believe we'll drop either some snippets or the full length, to be honest, on Instagram. So there'll be links, but we've been dropping little hints and stuff and some looks from the film and stuff over the last couple of months, because I just kind of want to keep the beaks wet.
Keep the buzz going.
Yeah.
Yeah. I gotcha. Well, I want to follow up on a couple things really quick, and then we're going to jump into some tips on kind of like traveling and putting this together from what, you know, worked for you guys. But you mentioned backcountry skins. So we had Kelly on episode 532.
Oh,
we'll have
yeah.
a link in the show notes to that one. And we also had a really cool one. Well, you mentioned this a little bit, but just the West versus the East, right? We're going to talk about that. But I mean, we've been doing a lot of East trips the last, you know, a few years. And one we've been doing is this trip with Jeff Liskay and Rick Kustich. You know, we fished New York for the first time for Steelhead. And I think that, you know, Steelhead is, again, a lot of people think West, right? Steelhead is the West. But
yeah,
we've been really telling that story about how amazing the Great Lakes are, you know,
yeah.
for Steelhead, even though these species aren't native to the area. It's this really cool story. So I think that the West versus East, for those that realize it, it's not like a comparison. It's really like, you know, we're all fishing. And I want to follow that up with the Hungry Trout, Rachel Finn, episode 72. Which was probably one of the great ones ever. I think she cussed like 100 times on that episode. And she's just amazing. But what she said was, she said, it's all about the hang. Like I asked her like, God, where's your bucket list trip? Which I don't really ask too much anymore, but you know, where is that trip? And she's like, man, your bucket list trip might be in your backyard. You
yep.
know, and the way she talks, she's like, man, she's like, dude, it's in your backyard. And she's from New York. And she just kept saying like, you know, it's wherever you are. It doesn't have to be like freaking Belize. You
right.
know? And so anyways, I love that you guys are doing this, because I think connecting this is like what fly fishing is about. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not about spending a bazillion dollars on a trip, you know, to wherever, but it's about just getting outside.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think, and that's the funny part too, because we actually did the trip in correspondence with the Hungry Trout, which is right on the Osceola
oh, nice.
River. So it's a funny connection and everything. Like we even saw Rachel at the fly fishing show here in Edison, New Jersey, just a couple of days
oh,
ago.
Cool.
So it is super cool.
Yeah. Did she have a stogie there?
Honestly, she was like six booths away and we were with the Trout Routes guys for the day. So you know what? Maybe. Who knows?
Maybe. All right. Well, let's talk about that. We've talked about Trout Routes a couple times. I want to talk some tips on how would somebody put together a similar trip, you know, just kind of these remote trips. So let's start with Trout Routes, because it's so important to have something to, you know, kind of help you on these journeys. So how did you guys utilize Trout Routes, and then talk about a few other tips that helped you make this successful?
Yeah, no. So, I mean, we talk about it in the film a little bit too, is there was a really tough time selecting a river. And it's because we know how a lot of these rivers fish in the spring, but we've never gone to these rivers in the Adirondacks in the fall. And so when it came to trying to source a river or find a river, Trout Routes made it pretty dang easy because of the, like their grading system on these rivers. So like the Aux-Sable is a gold class river, and it's also a famous river. Like it's pretty well known for its trout fishing and its natural species and how it performs kind of in the Adirondacks. We had a couple other rivers that were like on the class one rating on the app, and we were really veering towards those ones. But we, as you dive into the, it's almost like checking off little filters. Like when you're shopping, we were able to check off these little filters of like, hey, which river should we get to? We got these class systems. All right, let's get these ones in the class one and the gold class. All right, let's click into those. What's the gauges at? What do they normally flow at? We needed to be able to float the river and not scrape the entire time because we were in pack rafts. Mm. And obviously Cocopelli makes an amazing raft, but like the rocks in the West are so sharp. Like for some reason out here, they're sharp and they're slippery and everything. So we kind of wanted to make sure that we minimized how much time we'd be actually like wading through the water, pulling boats and portaging. And Trout Routes made it super easy just because you've got your, in general planning stuff, you've got obviously the class system, you've got your river miles, which is an awesome new feature that actually hit just before we went on this trip. So it was a perfect timing, because we were like, we can follow the road and we can sit there. My buddy Addison, when we had just started planning this trip in like August or something like that, he got Google out, like Google Maps, and he drew two lines on that tiny little thing that says like 1,000 feet is this much, like that little marker on the bottom left, drew two lines on a piece of paper and was trying to count like how many miles we were going to be, when we were going to be floating. And so like that made it amazing and so much easier for sure to plan this trip. But then the other thing too, is we knew we had attributes of this trip, which was we needed a camp. We needed to get out of the boats and we needed to actually stay on public land and make sure that we weren't like staying in some dude's backyard. And Trout Routes gives you all the capabilities of checking through your private and your public land, which was amazing because the first maybe, I think it was like 4 or 5 miles of the trip, we were going to see only private land. So we knew we couldn't get out on the banks, at least like a certain portion up to where like the water level hits. But that was the other thing too. The more that you dive into it, the more features you find in Trout Routes. Like we were able to the river, because we downloaded the maps. That's another thing you can do. We downloaded the maps. We were able to check the regulations and we were like, oh, okay. So this is, it tells you what portions of the riverbed are green and good to go. And the portions that like, okay, you're impeding on someone's private land. And so that was super helpful in making sure that we did this trip respectfully as people who like that isn't our home river, but also just making sure we were just treating the river right and as right as we could and treating the people around it as right as we could so that we're not kind of like causing a stir or getting anybody angry while we're filming something that's supposed to be a fun adventure and all that. So yeah, Trout Routes was just really, really helpful when it came to planning the trip. And then when it came to actually executing the trip, it was even more helpful because we can see within feet where we are to a new camp spot. We have the river miles like counting down. We can see all that sort of stuff. And the days before the trip, we actually, there was a shift in the idea of the trip because we're going to float, I think like 17 miles or something like 20 miles. And we actually had it cut in half because we checked the gauges. We actually went into the shop and we showed him the app and we were like, are we good to float this long? Like, is this section? And he was like, yeah. Ooh, he goes, actually, let me bring you over to this map. He brought us over the map and then we compared it with Trout Routes and he was zooming in on Trout Routes. He's like, yeah, so this section here is going to be so absurdly bony that you guys aren't even want to, it's going to get dangerous. Like it's going to start to get dangerous because you're going to be walking, waiting. And then all of a sudden we realized that section itself, which would normally be like a healthy class 4 or whatever, and turned into like a bony class 6, like it just like, oh, like wow, through the like off the charts type of like danger. And so we were like, well, good thing I guess we had the gauges and all of the like info in the app that actually made it so that we didn't get ourselves into trouble because we were carrying 80-pound boats. Like our boats were fully stocked full. They're originally 9 pounds by themselves, but we chocked them full of gear and camping equipment and food and all that sort of stuff. And we're planning to spend days on the river. So it ended up cutting our trip in half, but it made us stop and fish a lot more, which I think is one of those things. You just like open yourself up for an adventure. And the tools like Trout Routes are those things that are kind of like the vessel that it pushes you to have an adventure like this.
That's awesome. And I was going to ask you about that. So that's perfect on the mile. So you ended up being more like 8 or 10 miles. Was that kind of the total length of the trip?
Yeah, I think it was like 10-ish, maybe 11 miles. So it was almost like a true just like chop in half, which at first I was like, oh, like this is really going to like, it's going to mess with the story. We're not going to be able to spend as many days out. And we actually ended up spending the exact same amount of days out. And we just stopped at holes and fished for hours instead of seconds or minutes. And so it actually made it a way more successful trip in terms of actually fishing, which I think is exactly what we came to do. If you kind of just like dumb it all down, is like we came to fish and we came to have like a fun adventure with two guys in the outdoors. And that's what it ended up turning into. And I'm kind of grateful that we had that shift.
Couldn't you talk about the river that you fished? Is that something that's not a secret or is this one?
No.
Or was it the Aux-Sable?
It was the Aux-Sable. Yeah, it was the West Branch of the Aux-Sable, which I don't feel too bad about saying what it is only because it's a famous river. It's like it's pretty famous here in the East. And so like a lot of people know about it. They know about the chasm and all that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, it's a wild river. And like without all the planning and all of the like the conversations with the Hungry Trout and with Trout Routes like in our pockets, I think this would have been a terrifying trip. But it ended up turning into something where we felt really well prepared in order to set it up for adventure to happen and be able to explore these rivers and do what we would normally do, which is fish and have a good time. The Aux-Sable River, a beautiful section of the river for sure. I mean, it's crystal clear, it's gorgeous. There's massive fish in it. Like you're floating over these little sections of water and you're looking down and you're seeing just these monsters moving under the surface. And the other thing about like Adirondack water, for people who are around it all the time, they know there's this like, it's like a, it's not murky, but it's brown. Like it's brown, but it's crystal clear. And so sighting a fish is nearly impossible. You just kind of have to go on your gut and be able to read the water. And most of the time you'll pull a fish up, but it's going to take 5 or 6 passes. And you might have to switch up your approach like a ton of times. I think that that was one of the things that I was having trouble with, because I come back from the West and I'm trying to throw hopper droppers the entire time, just because I had so much fun doing it out West. But there are different tactics that you have to try first when you're here in the West, because some time or most of the time, the fish I feel like are spookier here, and it can go both ways, I feel like. But yeah, like, I mean, trying indicator stuff and trying to take your indicator off or your bobber off altogether and like tight line it with your 9'5" weight, trying to right. get down to these spots and switching up weight and flies and presentation and all that sort of stuff. It's kind of the puzzle of it that I love so much about the East. But yeah, I was a little bit stubborn at first and was trying to throw these just meat on the water, and wasn't proving to be as successful as my buddy, who is literally, he's like tried and true, because he knows these waters. He has started fly fishing around the same time I did. And we both, when we get into a hobby or something like that, we go into it like way too hard. We'll spend days and days fixating on like just how to do this tactic or how to do this thing. And we'll constantly text him like, oh, like we should try this next time we're out on the water, sending videos, sending instructional stuff back and forth. So when we learn something, I don't think it's a skill we're learning it super, super fast. It's because we're oversaturating our brains with something. And so we just end up picking up kind of years and years of knowledge, and obviously so much stuff to learn. I learned like years of stuff out West, but yeah.
That's cool. So we talked about a couple, you know, just tips on planning a trip like this, but you mentioned kind of, I think, the trout routes or some sort of mapping software, downloading the maps, having that. Also, stopping by the fly shop, you know, is a good thing wherever you're going. What would be a few other tips you'd throw in there that made your trip successful out there?
Yeah, I think just general research, like literally as simple as Googling the river and Googling the things that you're going to be doing on that river is definitely helpful, because there are things that like Trout Route specializes in a few specific stuff, but they're not always going to have like just tons and tons of Google articles on the app. Like that doesn't make sense. So like Googling like a bunch of people's like blog posts about like, hey, I floated this in 2015. And obviously that's super far back, so not super helpful.
Sure.
But like you can get a good idea. And if they're saying that the range was good at this point, and they're like, oh, like it was floating at like 500 CFS, say, and it was, that's a really healthy section for the river. That gives you context to go back into your app as a staple and go, okay, like where is it normally good when people are talking about floating as opposed to fishing? Or where's a nice in between? Because I know that Trout Routes has like the colored system. They've got the red for like, oh, this is way too low, or it's way, way too high. And then green when it's in a good spot for the area statistically. So that's super helpful to see if it matches up with what someone who's kind of been out on the river, and most of the time it does. Actually, I'd probably say all the time it does. And so, yeah, by just kind of doing just general research is definitely helpful when you're planning something that you're could potentially be doing something that is a little bit more on like the wild side of things. Like it sounds like we had a pretty good grip, but I'm going to be honest, like we were pretty nervous about going out into this deep of the backcountry for the Adirondacks, because we grew up around it and we know how dangerous it can be. And even just beforehand, we got a call that like they are trying to recover somebody who like had gone missing in the river type of thing. And so even to the days that we were going up, we're still finding out how dangerous the river can be and how important proper planning is. And that's just one of those things that like Trout Routes comes in so handy for.
Perfect. What do you think is the best time of year to fish, to do a trip like this, kind of this remote, you know, sort of backcountry thing, at least in the Au Sable?
Yes. Yeah. For the Au Sable, it's definitely going to probably be spring. I think like most of the guys were telling us like, this is crazy. Like, you're not going to want to float it now. Like there's all these things against you type of thing. And thankfully for ourselves, like as we got closer and closer to the trip, things kind of like came together and it ended up working really well, where like the fall is a beautiful season to go up there, because we were in there full color, full fall foliage, and it was just gorgeous the entire time we were up there. Plus it's slightly warm, so you're still getting terrestrials, you're still getting like hoppers that are falling on the water, you're still getting like little caddis hatches and stuff, so you still can do some dry flying, which is amazing. But I feel like the spring is when the water's high. you got all that snow melt and that runoff.
Yeah, more water.
Yeah, and so just in general, the fish are moving a little bit more. I think we kind of put ourselves there in terms of a fishing space. It was a little bit of a grind, but like it was doable. We caught fish, and like with our level of experience, like it was something that was just like, it was so much fun to pick apart that puzzle. But definitely, I think Adirondack rivers in general, we go up to the Adirondacks every year for my birthday, and we will fish a couple rivers in the like the middle of the Adirondack region. And the spring is always just an amazing, amazing time to get up there and fish, because the fish are just going wild. Like they're coming off of the winter and being super slow and lethargic, and like you can get like these crazy dry, like these early like dry fly hatches in like May and June ish and it's just a good time. I feel like it's one of those places that you can go to, and it's like the idea and the experience is like the dream of the West. You're surrounded by mountains and you're in these beautiful crystal clear waters and you're catching fish, and like you can't go wrong with that.
Amazing. What is the Adirondacks? Maybe describe from what you know, what makes it so special? What part? It looks like it's a massive, I'm assuming kind of massive forest and canyons, yeah, and mountains. Maybe talk a little about what you saw on your adventure.
It is an amazing, amazing thing. And I think that's what is nice, is that we do have these differences across the states. I think that's like one of the benefits of having the East and the West. Like the East is gorgeous as well. Like it's most of the time, like your peaks aren't as high as Colorado peaks, so they're covered in trees. So you're not seeing the mountains like you'd see the Rockies, or you're seeing all these like these summit places where like it is gorgeous out West, but it's beautiful in its own regard here in the Adirondacks. And so in the East, we have like I was saying, like crystal clear, freezing cold, like mountain streams, and they are pretty big. Like I would say like they're pretty like large scale rivers, decently high flow rates. I think the Aux Sable during Christmas time went from, when we floated it, I think it was like 500 CFS. And in the winter, like in Christmas time, when we had a kind of a crazy melt here, it got to 20,000 CFS, which, wow, is absurd. Like they had to close down roads because the water was up over bridges. And so like, just like that, you'll have these wild things that happen. But I would say it's kind of nice that there's differences in terms of how things look. Like there's a characteristic Wyoming river, and then there's a characteristic Adirondack river where the park is massive. I think there's a fact where there's multiple national parks you can fit inside of the Adirondacks.
Oh, wow.
And I think includes Yosemite. Yosemite is one of the ones, and all that. And so like Yosemite is a massive park. And so are all the other ones that there's listed, but there literally is a fact that says like there, you can fit like five or six of those national parks inside of the Adirondack mountain range.
That is crazy.
Which just means it is so, it's so big, and it's right in our backyard.
Yeah. Well, this is cool. I was going to say, you know, I mean, I think that's a great fun fact that, you know, like the size of it, because when you look at it from a map, and I don't know all the details, but essentially it's kind of that whole kind of northeastern part of New York. And it's almost like, gosh, I mean, you might say it's like this, like a third of the size of New York is this big chunk of,
oh yeah,
of like kind of remote, right? I mean, there's towns in there, but that's the Adirondacks. It's this giant area. It's amazing.
Yeah. And you can go 45 minutes or so without actually seeing another town. And it's kind of like these mountain towns out West. Like there's a lot of similarities. And I think that's what's so nice, is there's familiarity like across the states, but it all is so different. Like it looks so vastly different, where you have like almost hills and mountains as a combination in the East. And then out West, you obviously have the huge mountain peaks. But I did find the fact though, if you wanted to hear the how many parks can fit in.
Yeah, let's hear it. This is good. This will be our fun fact. I always love to throw a fun fact in here. So let's hear it.
Dude, it's perfect. So it says right here, it says, it would take these five national parks added together to equal the size of the Adirondack Park. And the following parks are Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, Yosemite, Everglades, and the Great Smoky National Parks. Those can all fit inside of the Adirondack Park, which is nuts. It's one of those facts where it's like, when you're picturing the East, like you don't think the New York has something that big in it. And that's what it is. That's like the reality of it. And it's wild.
And it is a national park. It is actually a national park. I didn't realize that.
Wait, I don't think it's a national park. I think it's a state park, but you can fit those five national parks in it, which is wild.
Yeah. But it sounds like it should be a national park. It sounds like to me, it should be a national park.
Yeah, like with as big as and as vast as it is, and I think there's, you know, the funny thing is we used trout routes actually, which I didn't mention this to you before, but we used trout routes to plan a backpacking trip literally 4 days before we hit the river for this other trip in the Adirondacks, an hour away from where we put the boats in. And so like planning that, like planning a hike-in trip even to like a remote lake. And then like we hiked like 10 miles or so, but it took us like 3 hours, almost 4 hours to get in there. Cause it's just so it's big, like it's a big park and the terrain is crazy. Even this is one of the other things too, that I like, I'll compare it to is like in the West, I like, we can hike like 11 miles and we'll summit a mountain out there and it'll be like a decent like hike for the day. In the East, you have a 3 mile hike in the Adirondacks. And the last mile and a half, you are on your hands and knees, like pulling yourself up rocks, because like, it's like a big joke on social media too. Like you'll see these people posting like, oh, like a hike out West or whatever. And they're just like meandering and they're chacos and stuff. Yeah. And I tried to wear chacos and there was literally a ladder, a bridge, and then a section for like 400 or 500 feet where we just had to crawl up on our hands and knees. Like we were literally like rock climbing. Oh, we were bouldering.
Did you guys ever get to a place where you were like kind of scared for your life or any close calls or anything like that on your trip?
I think on the actual float trip, I think we had it so planned out that we knew the river really, really well at that point. Obviously not seeing it in person is a whole different thing. But we actually camped the night that we got into town at, I think it's called the Wilmington Notch, which is like right in between the Hungry Trout and where we were going to start a float in Lake Placid. And so we were in that area and me and my buddy were like, well, I think there's water down there. It's pitch black by the time we got there, but we ended up finding this map and it said, oh, there's water down there. And we were like, this is definitely the Au Sable. We should try to go down there in the morning. And so we woke up, we walked down, we grabbed like a rod and the camera and stuff. It's actually the intro to the film, which is actually kind of cool. And not only did my buddy catch 3 fish, like right off the walk in, like we walked in through like a stone fly in there under an indicator and he was on fish immediately in this one little spot. But there was right next to us a nearly 60 foot tall waterfall that if we actually had gone through with the full float, we would have had to go around that.
Oh,
and
man.
So that right. portion right there, and the guides at the shop were even telling us like, just so you know, you have to constantly have your hand on your map. Like just always be checking your map, make sure you got like notifications. We had an InReach with us as well. And that was just for the remote sections. But it was really just in case we needed help and we were in an area that we didn't have like the ability to get service or something like that. But they were telling us that like, you're not going to know when like a drop off is happening. The water's loud the whole way down and you'll see a couple of boulders or whatever, but then it just drops. Like you're not going to get any warning because all of the surrounding banks and everything kind of jut out like the rest of the banks would on the entire river. And then just in between it, there's a hole and there's just like this pocket of like, I think the chasm is like another 40 foot drop, which I believe like some Red Bull guys have gone over, but like they're prepared to do that. We have pack rafts. We have got camera gear. We're also not sending it over 40 miles, like in rafts that can handle class 4. And so I think that was a terrifying realization. And that almost it put like a pit in my stomach because I was like, I sure hope that the other stuff we're going to encounter is not
right.
like this. Like this is.
Yeah. Come down in a 60. Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is, I love the remind me part of this is I think safety is definitely one of the things, you know, getting, and also just having a great trip.
Yeah.
You know, that's why the planning that we're talking about is so important that you plan. And then you don't have some situation where maybe your trip ends because you guys didn't realize,
right.
you know, some feature, right? So it sounds like things were pretty successful. Like literally, like we talked trout routes, all this stuff of planning, you guys had a successful trip. There wasn't anything where really your trip was cut short or anything like that.
No, we didn't have anything. And actually we had a spot where our trip was extended a little bit, which was actually kind of sick. The guide that we've been talking to, Brandon Seifert, who works for the Hungry Trout. And we've had a couple of run-ins with him as well because of some Reddington trips and all that stuff. And so he's hung out with us before, but he like met us at the takeout spot. And he was like, dude, I got something for you. Cause we didn't get to experience too much, like too many rapids while we were there, just because the section that we had kind of cut off was where all of the white water would have been. But only if the water like level was high would we have seen successful white water. So the first section that we had rowed was, we had some hairy water, but it wasn't wild. And he was like, I got a spot. Also, we'll be able to catch fish. I was like, all right, heck yeah. And this dude is a trained EMT. He works for Whiteface Mountain in the winters, a ski patrol. He's also a class A guide. This dude knows the area, he knows his stuff. And like, that was one of the biggest pulls for us to be like, extend the trip a little bit. And like, yeah, heck yeah, we'll unload our rafts, we'll grab some rods, and we'll go wherever you're going. And he's like, we get down to the spot and he goes, just quick thing. You guys are probably the first people to float this section. And I was like, okay. I was like, yeah, that's a wild fact. And he's like, I mean, I'm sure someone may have done it, but it's not recorded that someone's done this. And so he brought us down to this one section that was like, you could only get to it if you floated down a couple of like class 3, class 4 rapids. And so we were like, all right, heck yeah. We grabbed the rafts and we were eager to be shown how to do it correctly, because in the beginning of the film, we kind of talk about how Addison and I have never really had experience with white water. Besides my float trips, and I wasn't the one rowing. So it's a whole different thing when you're just sitting in the front of the rowboat. And so him as he's also a whitewater instructor. And so like he's walking us through it and you feel way better. And that's another thing is like that reassurance of safety. But he brought us down into this chasm and we ended up like floating until it kind of just started to get dark out. And then we ended up having to like tie our boats with NRS straps around our waists and like portage the entire way out, which was an entirely different adventure all in itself. But it was one of those things where we had created such a good foundation for this entire trip to be successful that moments like this could happen. And it was just, I think it was one of those things that was just like an added like cherry on top. We got to go catch fish with the guide and also float these crazy white water sections, film a bunch of it. And it was super fun to like learn recovery stuff. And thankfully we didn't have to do any like safety protocols or anything like that. But yeah, it's just like, I think this trip in general, having the tools like we had and having the companies that jumped on board with us made it amazing. Like obviously like Cocopelli and Reddington and Topo Designs for clothes and all that sort of stuff. And it was really cool. And having Trout Routes is that base layer that we needed basically to make this trip super, super successful.
That is cool. And how do you spell the boats? What is that? The boat again you guys used?
Yeah, Cocopelli's. We use the Rogue R decks. They are Kokopelli are the Cocopelli rafts.
Yeah.
And those things are sick. Like one quick little thing, just because we didn't know it until we got the rafts. Like my buddy does more research than I do. And like, I'm already researching really hard. But he was like, dude, I looked up the rafts that we're getting and stuff. Cause Cocopelli was kind enough to send us two. Like it was so, so awesome getting a connection with those guys. And they were like, yeah, like we'll hook you up. They hooked us up and we have never had an experience like this in rafts and stuff. Like it was amazing.
And they're kind of like a mix between it's a raft, but it's kind of, how big were these boats? Cause they have a little few different, what was the model again? I'm curious, is this more like a kayak or more like a raft?
It's a raft for sure. So it's like a Rogue R deck. They're personal rafts, so they're not quite massive, but they're also not terribly small. I think they're like 6 feet long, and maybe about 4 foot wide or something like that. But the coolest portion about these boats is that we had so much gear. We had like these bags from Patagonia that we were going to be using to put the cameras in. Those would get strapped behind our backs, but all the rest of our gear, our sleeping bags, our sleeping solutions, like our hammocks, our rain flies, charging battery power, all that stuff had to go somewhere else. And normally when you do these trips, you just chuck it in a big go bag, like between your legs or something like that. The Cocopelli rafts have a huge zip on the side of them and you stuff the tube with your gear.
Oh, no kidding. The tubes. Yeah. Literally, you're putting your gear inside the tube.
Inside of the tubes, which actually helps with buoyancy. It helps with the rigidness of the raft. So like when you're actually stuffing a sleeping bag that's the exact same size as the tube and then all your gear in these clothes and these stuff sacks, you kind of just make it even on both sides. And then you have like almost this trunk amount of space for an extra backpack or a bunch of food or whatever you want to kind of keep close to the zipper. You zip it back up and then you fill it with air, and the air and your clothes create the structure of the raft. And you can do it without them.
That is amazing.
But it makes it so much more rigid. You're hitting stuff. And if you're bumping into walls and stuff, you've got the impact brace of not only the airtight tube, but you have your sleeping bags in there. So you're kind of like bumping that. And it's a lot less stress on the boats. And it just means you can do like a little bit more of like wild water stuff without being worried that all of your clothes are going to be wet when you get to camp type of thing.
Right. So it's again, and go back to this. So you have this tube, you unzip it and you literally are putting all your stuff in all the tubes.
Yeah.
And then so, cause it's not a big boat. Yeah. I mean, like inside the boat, you're having a few little items like they're sitting out, but for the most part, everything's in, all your gear's stuffed in the tubes.
Yeah. And they sent us these waterproof bags that go on the tip of the boat. So like we could keep extra reels in there. I kept like snacks and water and all that sort of stuff, but the bags themselves are pretty big. These things fold down when you're done with them to a 9-pound little package with the oars included. So they're super portable, amazing. Which is amazing. But when they're filled with 80 pounds of gear each, the portages were a little bit rough.
Oh, right. Yeah, you're full. So now you got to pick this whole thing up and just carry it or as best you can.
Yeah, there was a couple times where I like deflated it and then grabbed the heavy parts because I had a Jackery battery system in there, which is obviously the heaviest portion. And it was like in my topo bag or whatever. So we took that out and we took a couple of the heavy items out, but like the sleep systems are obviously not weighing too much.
This is great. I love the gear. The gear talk is always a fun one. And this sounds like an amazing boat.
Oh yeah.
What was the camping like on the, how many nights? So you had like 11 miles. Did you camp a couple nights or like how many nights were you out there?
I believe it was 3 nights. And it's get cloudy in my head just because the trip was in September and I haven't looked back through all of the footage yet, but I believe it was 3 nights.
Sure.
And we used like the E&O hammock systems, which I wasn't super into. I was like, I told my buddy, I was like, dude, it's not going to be great. It's not going to be comfortable. I don't know why you want to do that. Cause out west, there's no trees. So like, even if you're near the river, like there's not that many trees. If you're at summit, like obviously there's not going to be too many trees up there. And so I was like, we should just get like some tents or something like that. And we'll get like sleeping mats and all that sort of stuff. And we'll just do that. And he was like, dude, no, he's like, I've backpacked enough in the Adirondacks that like, just listen to me on this one. I was like, all right, deal. I was like, I've taken the rein and the lead on like kind of planning the other aspects of gear and all that sort of stuff for the trip. I was like, you take this one. So he's like, cool. This is what you need to get. We got a rain fly. We got an underquilt, which I didn't know existed. And then we got I already had the E&O hammocks because like every outdoor person has like four of them somewhere. And so I had the hammock, the underquilt, and the rain fly, and then a sleeping bag and a pillow. And most comfortable I've slept in months. Like he showed me like all these little tricks of like, you kind of like how you find the tension in the actual like, ties from tree to tree, finding the right tree distance type of thing. And thankfully the Aux-Sable, it's like in the west, we have thickly brushed banks, or sorry, in the east. And so like even walking into some of these spots was like, you'd have to like just bushwhack through some of these things. So we're like just trying to walk through and not, like trying to take deer trails, like, and not like mess a bunch of these areas up. And thankfully we didn't have to pat anything down or anything. We found a bunch of spots that were just dirt and some pine needles and stuff. And then we put our hammocks up in like a little formation just so that we kind of like were able to kind of block out anything from the outside of the camp and whatever. But it was amazing. Like I truly haven't slept that well in like months. And I like, we have a pretty nice bed here in the van. And so I was like, this is insane. He's like, yeah. He's like, once you get that tension right, he's like, it is just as comfortable as sleeping in bed. You don't have to feel like you're in like this banana shape the entire night. Like once you get it right, I was like, wow. And thankfully we didn't see any rain, which was great, but there was the Adirondacks are quite smoky when it comes to like fog and dew point and all that stuff. So we would wake up every morning and the rain fly would be drenched. And so I was like, wow, glad I listened to him and wasn't just like, I'll just do a hammock, which was what my original thought was before I like gave up and was like, yeah, man, honestly, you do know more about this stuff. So yeah, that's also one of the fun things about these trips is like the kind of diving into gear is like one of those nerdy things as well. But so much fun, like playing with these rods and figuring out sleep solutions and all that sort of stuff. Like it's super fun.
The gear is good. I think that everybody, a lot of the people that listen here love the gear talk like I do, you know, just like today. I mean, for those that don't know the Kokopelli rafts, I mean, that sounds like the one that you need, you know, the fact that they got that dialed. And then also, you know, you mentioned van life. I want to touch on that. We're going to take it out of here in a little bit with our conservation segment and all that, but let me just talk van life because I've had a few van, you know, people on that talked about it. So, and I always love this because I mean, it sounds like you literally have everything's in this van. So describe that. Like what is the van life? What does that mean to you? What is van life?
Yeah, so I can give a little bit of background. The idea kind of came out of the fly fishing stuff. I had always done like build outs of my vehicle so that we can get further and stay out further longer. And the van life thing was kind of the extreme, the most extreme version of that, where I was like, this is so much fun. And thankfully, my wife was like, okay. And I was like, wait, really? She was like, yeah, okay, let's do it. And so we like got rid of my apartment downtown in Rochester. And we actually, to practice, we moved into like my parents' camper that they had had on their property while I built the van, because I built the van from scratch. And wow. October of 2022, when we had kind of started this whole venture, I hadn't even touched a drill. Like my dad, and there's a video of my dad being like, what are you doing? Like he's like watching me hold a drill and he's like, what the heck? And so he had to like kind of show me a little bit, but then I kind of just took the whole project on. I mean, he helped me in some aspects of it, but like, I kind of just like took it on as like just a all in type of thing. After work from 9 to 5 at the studio, I'd come home and I'd work from 5 to 2 or 5 to 3 AM or whatever, working on this van for 8 months straight. And we filled it up with stuff that we would need, basically. So we were like fully committed to just kind of doing this van life thing and traveling for companies and traveling for the page and just creating adventure content, and as well as like tips and tricks stuff, because obviously I'm new. And it's when I started, there weren't as many videos on YouTube, or there weren't as many tips and trick things on TikTok or whatever about like how to get into fly fishing. There was a bunch of stuff I didn't know and I couldn't find the answer to. So I just kind of had to figure it out. And we don't have a huge fly fishing community in Rochester. There is one, but it's not massive like the West is. And so learning from other anglers wasn't really an option because I didn't know too many. As well as we don't really have a fly shop in Rochester. We've got a lot of big box stores, but like that's one of the things. I couldn't go to a fly shop and be like, hey, why do I need backing on my reel? Right. And how does it connect to my fly line? And then what's the clear stuff that comes off the end? Like, why is that how you set up a fly rod? The first time I set up a fly rod, I put the shooting head at my backing. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. And so, yeah, it was kind of like tips and tricks and stuff. And I wanted to create this, like this platform to kind of do that. But I thought that it would be best done and displayed from all of these places in the world that like, it's a dream of mine to pursue, is doing this full time, but like being able to do it in the van, which is again, like another tool that kind of allows us to create space for these big adventures. The van was a pretty cool tool, but to describe it a little bit, we have a bed in the back. It's a Transit for all the car guys.
Oh yeah. Oh, so it's a Ford Transit.
Yeah. Ford Transit. We ended up going with that, and I don't want to ruffle any feathers here, but the Ford Transit, we did pass a ton of the Mercedes Sprinters while we were on the road this year, and half of them on those mountain passes were smoking, and ours filled to the brim with water, with batteries, with a motorcycle off the back. We were flying by those dudes.
Oh, so you're saying the Ford Transit has been a great rig for you, and you've seen some other Mercedes.
It's been an amazing rig, because that was the biggest battle. It's like you want to get the Mercedes because they look sick. They look amazing. And I know a lot of people have really good experiences with them, but there was some tougher things when it came to like I didn't really want to have a diesel engine with gas prices everywhere. And when the only way to get a four-wheel drive vehicle from Mercedes is to have the diesel, or to like you get a dually or something like that. And Ford, it really was pretty much convenience. It wasn't necessarily my want for one vehicle or the other. It was whatever came up first, because finding a van during 2022 was insanely hard. But it really was just like, we found this one in PA, drove down, I traded my dream car in for it. We drove back up with a completely empty van, and then I spent the next 8 months of my life like head down using drills and like just creating this space that we would be happy to live in and would have ample enough power for us to not have completely uprooted our life, not being able to use like hot water and all the things that you would assume like van lifers are kind of doing. But thankfully we got into the game when most of the companies are pretty sophisticated with gear and how everything looks. But yeah, I was talking about the layout. We do have a bathroom. We have a full shower. We've got tons and tons of space for my camera equipment in here. And we also have, like, we got a fridge, we got a stove, we got a sink, and we have just added on a bunch of exterior things to the van for the Cocopelli rafts, because we didn't have those last year. So we needed a spot for the rafts and my safety equipment, my helmets for rapids.
It's all there. Is there anywhere you can see your this van? Is it out there online somewhere?
Yeah, it is. It's all over Instagram. We started the Very Good Van Build back when I kind of started everything. The only thing is I have been lacking and I haven't actually posted a tour of the inside. And so we're on our way to Florida now. And once the weather gets warmer and it's not insanely tough to open the door for a little while I film something, we're going to go ahead and get that together and just put it out, because honestly, we've made people wait too long. There was a ton of videos in the series, but like, we're just going to get the interior out because tons of people have seen the exterior and stuff. But yeah, TikTok and Instagram, there's a bunch of photos available, even sneak peeks of the interior and stuff as we kind of get closer to dropping the full look.
Gotcha. Yeah, the full look. So there is some places you can go out there and see it. And it's a, like you said, you got the, basically you build out the whole thing. So you've built a camper out versus say to go out and say buy, I guess the difference is buying like some camper that's already built out. The difference is that I'm guessing you save a lot of money and you build it customized. Like why go through the whole process of building it out, especially when you didn't have experience doing it?
Yeah, I think actually not having experience was the biggest reason why I did it, because if I went out and bought a camper, I would have no idea how every electrical line ran. I'd have no idea how all of the plumbing worked. And so if anything happened and I needed to fix something, like, thankfully, what's insane is me having no experience, we have not had to fix anything in this van.
How does that happen? Because did you teach yourself again, just go to somebody's Instagram or TikTok and you learn from them? Or how'd you do this?
YouTube. And that's the same way that I learned how to fly fish, to be honest, just because of the resources we had. But that's kind of how I've learned how to do everything when it comes to like music, because I had a career in music before I had started filmmaking and all that sort of stuff, is YouTube. Like, I learned all these things on YouTube and kind of just kept going and kept finding videos. And thankfully, there's tons of resources. Whereas like 2 years ago, there probably wouldn't have been. People just had to figure it out. But yeah, that building it all just makes sure that like if anything happens on the road, which a couple times we've had like, oh, this screw's loose, or I just need to tighten this quick little thing. At least I know every joint of the plumbing and I know every input of the wiring, so I can just go right to it. And I'm like, this is exactly what's wrong and I can fix it, as opposed to spending days or having to take it back to a shop in Montana where van builds are made. We don't have a ton of them in our like region, and have them fix it. And for it to be like super expensive every time and not to make this life, like, obviously supporting small business is amazing, but it would make it a little bit tougher for us to stay out for as long as we want to stay out if we had problems like that.
Yeah, gotcha. No, this is amazing. I think the fact that you did the van build out, and I'm looking at some videos now of on Instagram of you climbing up to the top of your, you got the ladder. Yeah, I mean, you got this thing down. So you literally bought this Ford Transit. It was nothing. And everything you see in it, you've just built this amazing camper.
It was empty. We updated the suspension and all that sort of stuff. And so,
right. It's a four-wheel drive.
Yeah, four-wheel drive. We put overlanding tires and a new suspension on it so it could handle being ripped around in the backcountry. And we've gone places that I wouldn't have taken my old Land Rover build. And I say that like very seriously because it would have like exploded my other car. This thing is tough.
I love this. No, I think that... you know, and what would be like the tip for you if somebody wanted to get, we actually thought about doing something like this, you know, never kind of did it, but what would be your tip for somebody that wanted to start doing a van build out? What would you tell them right now?
Yeah, no, I would say it is going to be a little bit of time. So you just have to be a little bit patient, but to be honest, the resources that are there and you don't have to do it super, super expensive. It can be done on a budget. And that's what we did. And so like, if it looks discouraging because you're going online and seeing all these builds that are over 200 grand or 150K, like buying the van and doing it yourself, like it's not going to be cheap, but it doesn't have to be as expensive as people think to get out there and adventure and live a dream.
Yeah. Love it. Perfect. Well, let's take it out here with our conservation shout out. And today, you know, we talked about Trout Routes. This one's presented by Trout Routes, of course. But talk about that. We always try to focus on conservation, you know, when we can and kind of give a shout out. Sounds like maybe that was part of your adventure here, but describe that. Do you have a conservation group you'd want to give a shout out to here?
Yeah. I mean, back home, we have the Seth Green chapter of Trout Unlimited and stuff. And I've gone to a meeting or two from those guys. And actually, I found out that we had one after we had kind of moved into the van full time and stuff. And so I haven't been able to attend as much as I'd like to, but there's also some efforts on the Au-Sable River with the Au-Sable River Association and the Adirondack chapter of Trout Unlimited, chapter 473, Lake Champlain. We got chapter 419.
Oh, yeah.
And all those dudes and ladies are doing amazing work to keep these rivers wild. And I think that's, it's really, really cool to see, because you spend so much time planning a trip for a river that it becomes your home water and you start to care about it in the way that you should care about all water. And so it kind of almost like forces you into this mentality of like, you fall in love with these places, you fall in love with these rivers and you want to protect them. And these guys are kind of boots on the ground doing exactly that.
Yeah. And so with the van, so you guys are actually, this is your full-time place. You guys are living in this thing. Is that the case currently?
It sure is. Yeah, we are full-time in the van as of right now. We go home periodically to kind of hang out in holidays and see family and whatnot, but we are full-time in the van, yeah.
So how does that work? Like, where do you actually stay? How does that work in like the daily?
Yeah, so in the East, it's a little bit tougher than it is in the West. And that is one of the things where like the West comes in strong, because there's dispersed camping spots, there's BLM land, there's tons of places that we can stay. And you can stay up for, I think it's 14 days in some places. There's a few places that are like 30 days on some of like the national areas in like Montana. And it just makes camping and getting outside really easy, because you're dropped at the foot of the Rockies, or you're like looking over a summit into some beautiful mountain lake, and you're just out there, and there's no campsites for like a couple miles because they are dispersed. They're exactly what the name says. So out West, it's a little bit easier. Out East, they still have them. And a lot of states are doing a really good job at starting to implement them a lot more. It just makes so much easier for people to get out and not like have to have a budget. In New York, it's pretty expensive. Unfortunately, like to go camping, it could cost you like $150 a night to go camping. And a lot of people don't have that. They just want to get outside with their kids and do that sort of thing. And so like a lot of these states are implementing cool resources for people to camp for free. And that does exist in New York, but it's a little bit harder to find. But currently we're stationed and from some of my Instagram posts, we're at my buddy's shop, Cheeky Servo in Virginia Beach. Right now, we stopped because we got to do some repairs on the bike. It's actually not the van that needs repairs. It's the bike.
Oh, the bike.
Yeah. So he runs a vintage motorcycle shop and stuff. And we have a motorcycle off the back. We got new tires. We got new grips. We equipped this little 125 cc bike for off-roading. And I think it is going to be so much fun in some of these areas. Cause I honestly, wow, in a day, I can't walk as far as I'd like to walk to find water and stuff in some of these areas, and bringing the van's a little bit clunky. So we got a couple toys.
You got a couple toys. So I guess, yeah, this is part of the thing. Like I'm guessing you're remote with your day job.
Yep.
So this is kind of remote. So you could go anywhere, work anywhere. So you pretty much just travel around the country and you know, wherever you have to, you're fishing. I mean, that's pretty much what you're doing, camping along the way.
Yeah, it is super, super awesome in order to be able to like to do stuff like that. The company that I worked for back home, Tone Studios, like they've allowed me to kind of do this remote and as a contract worker. And so, yeah, it's fun because I still get to pursue like fun things. Like obviously I get to fish and do all those sort of things, but then I also have the ability to kind of keep us out here on the road. And the page is turning into something that is doing a little bit more of that and pulling some more weight and stuff. So being able to do it full time, I think, is the goal. And I think we kind of are,
yeah,
like forcing it. Like we're just like, let's just do it. And so we kind of are just doing it, but yeah, it's a cool thing. And I do feel super blessed to be able to kind of have this thing happening in our life.
Yeah, this is amazing. No, I think this is a pretty cool, you know, story. The fact that, you know, again, it goes back to, I think, the COVID thing. You know,
yeah,
that's the amazing thing about the COVID is that it happened. It was this terrible thing. But at the end of it, you really look back and you're like, you know what? COVID in a lot of ways helped people,
yeah,
with their lives, right? To realize like, man, we live one life.
Yeah.
You know, and like, why not just do this? Feels like you, that's what you guys have been doing. You're just kind of like doing it, right?
Yeah, that was definitely the mentality. And the light at the end of the tunnel was a real thing for COVID, for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's do our quick little rapid fire round as we take it out of here. And we're not going to get to all this today, but just give us a few. So these are going to be some rapid fire questions for you. So let's go to, we're going to talk maybe just a touch on TikTok.
Okay.
So for those out there, you know, we've got the Instagram, the TikTok. Like, what is your, if somebody is wanting to kind of understand TikTok, is it something you think everybody should kind of be on out there if you have a business?
I think so. I think in terms of a business, as well as just something that's like, there are so many insane creators, like not only wildly talented, but there are some like just there's just so much stuff that like I feel like you might miss about like the world and businesses and all that, like strategies that you could be using elsewhere and stuff if you're not kind of currently on TikTok. But it's also just like one of those places that you can kind of scroll for a little while like there's so many funny people on it and stuff, and you get a lot of ideas, and that's kind of the fun thing about the culture of it and whatnot. But definitely as a business, I think it's a really fun place for your content to be candid. And that's kind of a little bit of what I do, where a lot of my less polished stuff and a lot more of my everyday stuff kind of goes to TikTok. And it's just kind of what people kind of relate with. It's like, it's real life stuff. And it's a fun outlet to be able to do that. Whereas like Instagram is definitely polished, as well as even like YouTube shorts and stuff like that. Like it's more polished stuff and you're kind of creating quick story things. It's all fast media. Whereas TikTok, you can take a little bit longer, you can take a breath, and it's a fun place to kind of explain what you do and you're going to have an audience for it.
Nice, nice. Okay, perfect. And so again, on this kind of rapid fire, so your trip, we talked a little bit about gear item. What was kind of your luxury item on that trip? Other than all the camera gear, yeah. What was the one item that you brought that was, you know, kind of that luxury item?
Oh man, luxury item. I feel like it's got to be maybe the computer setup that I have in here. I don't like game or anything, but I did want to make sure that I had like a powerful enough machine and our TV and like our satellite. We have the Starlink. So being able to have internet access everywhere and being able to like watch TVs, especially for my wife, like where she likes to like sit down and like she'll like to cozy up and watch a movie or something like that when we're out in the middle of nowhere while I'm kind of sitting at the fire or something. That is definitely one of those like things where it's like, I didn't think it was going to be super possible to have like a TV mounted to the wall and a sound bar and all that sort of stuff. But like, we've kind of made it our home and we definitely justified it because of the fact that our home is here, is the van.
Yeah. So describe in that Starlink, talk about that a little bit. That's just the, who's behind that? That's kind of like a satellite, basically internet.
Yeah, it's the Elon Musk thing. It's like, it's his satellites and his kind of creation stuff. But Starlink is incredible. So for anybody who overlands or anybody who's kind of just out in the middle of nowhere, I've tested this next to fiber networks. I've tested this next to like really profound, like home Wi-Fi networks and stuff that run really, really well and don't have a ton of latency.
Right. Using your cell phone hotspot sort of thing.
Yeah. Like any of that type of stuff, it shoots it out of the water. Absolutely. It's a closed network. So you're not like tied down to someone in your neighborhood, like at 9 o'clock, everybody gets on Netflix and your speeds go down type of thing. You don't get throttled with it. It's a closed personal network and it works so incredibly well. Like the mountaintops in Cheeseman Canyon, being able to stream 4K video and also being able to work from my laptop at my office back home in Rochester. This thing is insanely powerful and it's a must have for anybody doing outdoor stuff.
What is the Starlink like? What does that cost per month?
Yeah, so the Starlink, it definitely is like a little pricier than I think like most cable stuff is, but it's like $150 a month. And then to actually get the equipment, because you need you've got like your Wi-Fi modem and all that sort of stuff, and then you have the satellite itself, and that is like $500 or something like that. You can get more expensive with it. There's packages that get like dumb expensive, but we have only needed this, and I can't imagine what those other packages would offer that don't do everything that you need type of thing.
Gotcha. So a couple $1,000 and you got this thing on, you know, basically the best, you know, as good as anything, really. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it's definitely an investment, but people use this on their houses. Like people will cut off their normal cable. Yeah. Like there's so many people, a lot of people in Europe will actually install the Starlink because there's so little latency with your neighbors and you're not getting throttled with speeds and stuff. It's just you. So it's a super powerful network and a lot of people will just opt to do this one time and then you pay $150. It's definitely like, it's something to budget for sure. Like I can totally understand, like if you're not out every single day and living out here full time where it could be like an odd thing to try to get, but like, it's definitely worth it. Even if you're not out all the time, it's definitely worth it.
That's it. No, that's a good tip too. What about the power on your van? How are you guys getting, you're out there remote for multiple days? Is this, generator or do you have, how do you do that?
Yeah, we have a generator as a backup, but we have an 800 amp hour system from Renogy. We've got a 3000 watt inverter. We've got some massive power because we kind of wanted to make sure that we didn't leave some of the luxuries of home at home type of thing. And so like my wife, if she wants to use a hair dryer or something like that, it's there. Like we can use it type of thing.
You can do it.
Oh, and I just as now as I'm thinking about it, I totally flunked on that question about like a luxury item. Do you mind if I give one more item?
Yeah, yeah, let's hear it.
So my wife is a barista back home and I was a barista for many years. And so we really, really love coffee. We got a lot of friends who roast in Rochester. There's a lot of amazing shops. Like, my wife worked at Clementine in Fairport, New York. So if you're familiar, stop in. But we have this this thing called the Outen Espresso Maker.
How do you spell that?
O-U-T-I-N, Outen Espresso Maker.
Okay.
It looks like a little thermos, but this thing makes like full-on espresso, fully remote. Like, you don't have to plug it into anything. It's got a battery on it. It's got a water heater. It creates the proper pressure for you to have like a real espresso shot. And we have like a nice machine at home and stuff. And so like, this comparison is crazy to be able to like have with us. And like, in the mountains, if I wanted to make a latte or like a cortado or something like that, we can do it.
How's that different, say, again, for the people that don't know, the espresso versus just, say, pour over on a coffee?
Yeah, the espresso is, it's a pressurized version of like the water going through the beans. And so like, you have a chamber that does, I believe most machines do like 9 to 20 bars of pressure. And so like, creating up a bunch of pressure and then forcing it through those beans creates like a more saturated shot.
So it's just more, it's more powerful. So the taste, the flavor is just, yeah, it's a little bit different.
Taste, the flavor, everything can be kind of like palated a little bit differently. The only thing is, most people might not know that like, a shot of espresso is still a little bit less than just a cup of coffee.
Oh,
and so like, if you're having a latte or something like that, you're not, it's comparable in some coffees, but like, it's not like something that should send you into orbit. Yeah. And so it's not terrible.
Yeah. That's good to know. This is good.
Yeah.
Well, again, I'm just going down a few of these because this is something I've been curious and we kind of passed up on. But so on your backpacking trip, you know, the gear food, what was your food? Were you guys doing kind of the freeze-dried meals, or what did you do while you're out there? Mountain House or something like that?
Yeah. I'm not endorsed by them at all. But Mountain House, I don't know why, like, I have this odd love for the like the freeze-dried food.
What was your favorite one? You gotta pick one Mountain House for the whole thing. What would it be?
No, I got this on lock. It's the beef stroganoff for sure. It, like, for some reason, like, the noodles like always rehydrate well, and the beef in there rehydrates well, and the sauce and stuff, and like, throw a little Tabasco in there. I know there's a lot of people who like bring like canned tuna and like canned chicken and stuff, and they'll like put it into the meals and make it a little extra, but honestly, just that and some Tabasco, I'll get it for like meals at work, which sounds insane, but like, I'll go to like REI and grab a Mountain House meal, and my coworkers are like, what the heck is your problem, dude?
Yeah.
Like, love the outdoors so much that you eat Mountain House all the time. They're great.
Awesome. Good. Well, and I want to throw out an Angler's Coffee shout out. If you haven't definitely heard of them,
yeah,
they are doing amazing stuff, great coffee, and they're doing awesome stuff for conservation as well. So
yeah,
we always love to give them a good shout. So cool, David. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Obviously, you know, we could chat here more. I'd love to hear more about the van, you know, the van life and everything. But I think we'll maybe hold that to the next one. And then hopefully,
sure,
when your movies get out there, the new one we talked about today, we'll definitely maybe follow up with you, see how all that's going. And yeah, man, appreciate all your time today. And we'll look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was super great to be on the show. I appreciate it, man.
How about you? Are you feeling like you're ready to go pick up that van? Maybe go throw it all in and hit out on the road and see how to fish every day looking ahead. I know I've thought about this in the past. I've definitely still think about that van, what it would be like doing this. So pretty cool to get some insight from David today. And if you haven't yet checked in with Trout Routes, you can head over right now, head over to your app store and just search for Trout Routes and find out why so many people are talking about the Trout Routes app right now. If you're interested in checking out some of our trips and some of the routes we're going to be doing this year, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/school and find out everything we have going. And also, if you search for a giveaway, wetflyswing.com/giveaway, we likely have a giveaway going on right now to give one of these trips away. And if you didn't listen to the episode on Monday from the Hungry Trout, this is where we went deep into the Aucable and we talked about the epic shop, the epic story, and everything there. So you could take this conversation further just in case you missed it. Hungry Trout, one of the big fly shops in the country. That one is just waiting there for you. I want to thank you for stopping by the podcast today and want to say, I hope you have a great afternoon, a great evening, or a great morning wherever in the world you are. And I appreciate you for spending time with us today. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.